Bibles, please, the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 1. We got those notes handing out here somewhere. Yeah, very good. We got notes coming out. Just a couple things in introduction. Generation Word webpage, we put up yesterday a chat room on the front page. And that means you go on there and you can talk to whoever else is online. It's kind of humbling because it'll tell you how many people are online right at the bottom of the little box there. You'll say, like, one person's online. That's me, you know. And then I also put a little forum in the back. Or now you can click right above. There's another, take you to another page, a forum, where you can dialogue. You can make comments, like issues and stuff. One, I just got up a general forum. And I also put up something about the trip to Israel. What do you think of the trip to Israel? Do you think you want to go? Something like that. Trying to generate some conversation. I can see some of you taking advantage of that and getting on there and preaching and sharing your thoughts, which is kind of what I was hoping we would do. But anyway, it'll be kind of something interesting. Up here, I've got a chart. This, I don't want to bore you here. This is a little business report. This is this month, July, right here. We're not done, but we, probably during church today, we're going to go up and over our highest total ever in the, we've ever been on our web page. This number of hits on a web page per month. We're at 2,016 last night. And our record before was back in March at 2,053. So that means sometime we're going to break the all-time hit record for the Generation Word webpage. We'll probably, when we still got like days of the month left or something. So that's good news. See, if you want to compare this to July from last year, by last year was 1,080. So we've doubled. A year ago, we've doubled. And if you notice the trend here, July, where we're, June was the low month right here. See, March was high, see, and then he take his little dip down here, bottomed out in June again, you see, and then see what happens by October if this continues. By October, if we double that, we're up well over 3,000 hits a month, and you don't know. I mean, who knows what's going on, but anyway, that's interesting. If you notice back here, we started about a year and a half before this, but this is our first record. I think that was when I put it on in October, but the first actual full month. We had 630 hits in one month. It'd be November of 2005. And so you can the progression right there. Just want to share that with you. I thought that was a good report and thought you might find that interesting. But anyway, go online if you would and chat. Go online and share your views. Just try not to be, you know, too controversial against what I think. But, you know, you go ahead and, you know, get close to the edge there. I thought Galen's sermon this morning was completely worth it. Yeah, me too. You know, all of a sudden about 50 people are online. Yeah. Anyway, but if that's what it takes to get hits, whatever it takes, we'll get in there. Okay, Genesis 1:1. Let's take a look right here. We're beginning. We're finally doing it. We're starting the book of Genesis. Where this ends, no one knows. But Genesis 1:1, the greatest book in the Bible, the greatest verse in the greatest book of the greatest book. Genesis 1:1, NIV, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that's all we're going to talk about today, right there. Seven Hebrew words. They're written across the top of your page there in Hebrew. Hebrew, you've got to read it right to left. So you got to read that backwards in that gray box there. The first word is the word Bereshith, which means in the beginning. It comes, the root word there is going to be resit, R-E-S-I-T, or resit. The next word, bara, very important Hebrew word, bara, created. Created, the word bara compared to the Hebrew word asa is different. The Hebrew word asa, it's all in the notes here, we'll talk about it as we go, maybe. Hebrew word asa is A-S-A-H. It means to create something out of material that already existed. Would be like, that's how you make a snowman. You build a snowman, or you asa a snowman, you make him out of the snow that's already on the ground. Bara is unique. The word created for bara here is a word that is only used in the scriptures of God's creative work. And it refers to creating something out of things that didn't exist before, out of nothing, to create something out. Man never baras anything in Scripture. Man, if he does anything, he's going to asa something. He's going to assemble something out of existing materials. Man never baras anything. So when it says created there bara, it is indicating out of material that didn't exist before. Nonetheless, we'll talk about that as we go. The next word, Elohim. It's the Hebrew word for God. It's translated in your most English Bibles simply as the word God, G-O-D, compared to Yahweh, which is translated Lord. And it's usually, if it's Yahweh in the NIV, it's translated Lord, but all capital letters, L-O-R-D. So if you're using an NIV Bible, not that that's the best Bible, but if you're using an NIV Bible, the Yahweh term would be all four letters, L-O-R-D, would all be in capitals. If it's the word Elohim, it's going to be translated G-O-D, capital G, little O, little D, Elohim. El is the singular form of that word, El, it means God. Elohim, the I am in Hebrew, is plural, it means gods. And so if you're reading in Psalms or Isaiah and they're talking about the false gods or the idols of the world, they'll use the word Elohim, which means the gods, little G-O-D-S. Here it is plural. And again, this is not, I do not think, and people have tried and I considered it. I don't think this is a reference to the Trinity, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. That's a true doctrine. Some people argue with that even. But I don't think that's the point right here. Elohim being used right here is like if you go to England and the Queen is making a statement and she says, "We had tea." Well, you're the only one that drank tea. Yeah, but we, meaning in the majestic form, we, I can't even talk to myself in the singular because I'm so majestic. I am a we. And I think that is what that word is referring to. Elohim, the God, the only all-encompassing, the total God who encompasses all things. We can only call him Elohim or the magnificent God. And then, of course, one more word. Then, of course, he's got the word for heavens and then the the word the earth is the word Eres, E-R-E-S, which is important as we get if we get through it again any longer here today. Eres is translated earth here, which is a correct translation. But throughout the book of Genesis, it's going to become the word land. So when God promises Abraham land, he promises him the Eres, the earth. But yet he puts boundaries on it. And so we realize it's not the whole planet. It's the land of Israel, or it's the land given to the people of Abraham. And so what's interesting here is from the very beginning you've got a word where God is establishing the word earth, but that word continues throughout Genesis and eventually becomes part of the covenant blessing given to Abraham, the same word. So we got those seven words, including in the beginning, bara, created out of nothing, Elohim for God, and then Eris, the term for earth. I got it written right down there. Bereshith is the Hebrew word, but the Septuagint translated. Now the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, where before the time of Christ, where the Greek began to rule the world, and they wanted a translation that people could understand, so they translated the Hebrew into Greek. They translated the word Bereshith with the word, the Greek word, Genesis, which means birth or origin. And so that's where the name comes from. The book Genesis is simply the Greek word, or the first Greek word in the Septuagint, Genesis, in the beginning. So if we were to have an English title for the book, it would be the beginning, or in the beginning, the book of the beginning. The Hebrews call it Bereshith, or the book of the beginning. There's some breakdowns there. Chapter 1:1 is talking about what we're going to talk about today. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then chapter 1, verse 2, up through chapter 2, verse 3, that goes up through the seventh day of creation, is another account or an interesting section. They're talking about the 7 days of creation that we're going to have to look at here in the next few weeks. And then after that, chapter 2, verse 4 through chapter 2, or verse 25, it's another creation account from a different angle, and so we can get some more information. So there's actually three accounts here that we got going. First of all, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. These are things that are destroyed, arguments or philosophies or gods that are eliminated in this first verse. Understand that when we talk about philosophies, this is a term that I've kind of used to identify idols of the Old Testament. You can think about idols in the Old Testament were little statues. They're wooden figures or stone figures or golden figures of their gods, their deities, and they would worship these idols. But it wasn't just this little image that they worshiped. They didn't think this rock ruled the world or necessarily ruled their particular area. What that rock represented was a whole philosophy. It explained to them their origins, where they came from. It explained to them their purpose in life was to serve this deity or to have this deity serve them. It represented their morals and their values. It represented where they are going in time. It put everything was encompassed. And so in other words, when I say the word idols or when I read the word idols in the Scriptures, I hear more of the word philosophy, a way of life, a worldview. If you worship Baal, you didn't just go yearly and offer a sacrifice to Baal. Baal's philosophy ruled your life. It was how you viewed your world. And so when you talk about idols, you're talking about philosophies, which is a good point for us as Christians. If we worship God, now this would be huge for us as a church, not just here, but I mean worldwide. if we actually allowed our God's philosophy to permeate our lives and we live that way. You understand what I'm saying? It's like, here, we believe this is our God. We believe in Jesus. We believe God's the creator of the world. He's the judge of the world. That's our philosophy. That's our idol. Well, theoretically, then, you're supposed to live that way. You're supposed to live in the fear of the judge, fear of the creator, in honor of who he is and of his philosophy. And I guess, you know, sometimes we have to admire false religions, people who actually worship idols or false philosophies, because they actually live according to those standards. And if we as believers would do the same thing as Christians, if we'd embrace his word, embrace his character in our own lives, and we'd be as good as an idol worshiper, we'd take some huge strides forward, if you understand what I'm saying. That's a little free message of condemnation brought to you today. Chapter 1:1, we got these things that this verse right here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. First of all, atheism, who says there is no God, can't be true according to this verse, because atheism says there is no God, but here God is beginning the whole process. Pantheism, which is the idea that there's gods in everything. Sometimes we get into, I don't want to get too particular here, but some religions believe that God is within nature, that God isn't outside of nature. See, we believe in this God right here in the very beginning. This God in the beginning, God who is already existing in eternity past without bearing on material things, without bearing on time. He's outside of material. He's outside of time. He is independently eternal. How old is he? He's been here before time was invented. He was here before time was created. And so he's just here. He exists independently. If creation would, and someday it will, be consumed with fire and disappear, where would that leave God? In the exact same place he originally was. God exists eternally. That's the Christian view. That's the biblical view of God. Pantheism believes that God or the gods are in creation. So to destroy a tree would be to destroy God. In other words, if creation were to burn up, God would be gone because God is in nature. We believe God manifests his character in nature. We believe God can be in this world. He became a man and walked among us. So he can enter into creation anytime he wants to. But if creation were to disappear, God is outside of creation. He's outside of time. Pantheism believes that God is nature. Now, that explains a whole lot of religions. And again, we could go off on that, but let's keep moving. Pantheism, God is in all, is not true because God is outside of all. He created all and is independent. Polytheism, there are many gods. This goes back to many of the foreign religions, even today sometimes. Polytheism, where there's many, many gods. This is only one true God. Dualism, the God of the Star Wars age. You know, good versus evil. We're in this battle between Jesus and Lucifer. No, there is no dualism. God is sovereign, God is creator, and there is evil, but evil is under his jurisdiction. Evil, Satan, all of this bad is under his jurisdiction. It is at war against him, it's opposite of his character, but he is not struggling against evil. You and me are struggling against evil, but Jehovah is beyond evil. He reigns over the whole thing. Dualism, although we ourselves struggle between good and evil in our own decision-making, God is not in that struggle. He is outside. Dualism is not what's taking place here. Star Wars is a great series, but Star Wars is not true. Next, maybe I shouldn't have said that publicly. I'm sorry. Some people are probably going to leave the church now, right? Now it's like probably walking out. Okay. Humanism, that man is God. Now this is getting real close to home, because no matter how you view your world, how you make your decisions, you are living in a humanistic society. And again, there's a great book coming out that deals with this here in the next couple weeks. But humanism is where we have grown up in, where we... our educational system, our governmental system. We've separated from the Christian worldview into the humanistic worldview. And so we are here, and even though we address God, and we would say the scriptures are inspired, we often find ourselves living under the philosophy and making decisions in our life as a humanist. And this is really our struggle, is we name the name of God, but every one of us at points in life are thinking and living like a humanist, and we've got to separate ourselves from, that's part of the renewing of your mind in Romans chapter 12. Humanism that says man is God and man is ultimately in charge and that there is no God. Well, and then evolution is basically saying this, materialism is God. Because for evolution to be true, It has to start, and no matter how you slice and dice evolution, something has to exist for the it started with a cell began to split. Right, but the cell had to be there. Now, if you really want to get into some, if you can become a theistic evolutionist, which believes in God, and there's some great people believe this, I don't, but there's some great believers believe this. They believe in God, but they also believe in the process of evolution. Now, I believe in the process of survival for the fittest, okay? You know, that's kind of common sense. You understand what survival for the fittest is. If you can't find food, you die. And all your species and all your genes die out because you couldn't find food. So if you can find food, you're going to survive and live another day. That's not evolution, though. Evolution is saying that in the very, very beginning, there was some matter. And then matter began to improve. Now, that would make, in a sense, matter, in a, not God in the sense that we think of a God as being a personal God, but it would make matter, or the material world, an eternal identity that exists alone, which is clearly false. Because even science itself, as evolution, again, we can't go off on this, but evolution began to become popular in the 1800s. But by 1920, the whole process that evolution was based on, science was proving it wrong. Enough on that. Okay. You remember? No, that's okay. Psalm 14:1 says, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God." And that can be interpreted a variety of ways. We're going just on this whole evolution thing. There is no God. You have now entered the class of the fool, and you're going to make all of your decisions in life from the criteria, from the base of information that a fool operates from. In other words, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Or it can say right there also, the fool says in his heart, no God, or no to God. He always says no to God. God's got a plan, God's got a way, and the fool always says no. Okay, moving on. How was the book of Genesis written? How did we get the book of Genesis? The New Testament, Luke, and Jesus referred to it as being the writings of Moses, so we believe Moses wrote the book of Genesis. That had come under some criticism. Now, stay with me. I told you on the way over here, this is going to be a great message because it was going to be a bunch of academic information answering questions that no one had ever asked before, and people are going to walk out saying, what do we do with this information? I don't know. I love the information, so I'm going to teach it. And you just hope the Spirit of God is going to move on your behalf and help you. Sometimes I worry, and Kathy said something before we came up here. I got that little thing I put on the web page, little dialogue box, the chat room. And she had to say this to the pastor. The pastor, the guy's going to be teaching the word. She had to say, because I'll be on there typing once in a while. She says, make sure you're nice. It's like, well, what do you mean? Just be nice. It's like, what kind of guy am I? You know? I mean, here I am. She's agreeing. It's like, you got to tell your pastor to be nice in the chat room, you know? And then he comes in a sermon. It's like, I don't care if you like it or not, but this is really good information. It's like, what a great church. The pastor got to tell him to be nice. He doesn't care if you like the information. Oh. But nonetheless, I'm going to press on. As the book of Genesis comes together, we've got a book, obviously. It's a document handed down through the Jewish, their book, their inspired scriptures. Where did it come from? Jesus referred to it as being written by Moses, and that was that's a traditional belief that Moses wrote the book of Genesis. I've got written down there somewhere on this page. Yeah, right there, underneath the word toledot. How do we decide to say that, Tony? We were talking about this on the way over here. T-O-L-E-D-O-T. We'll talk about that in a moment. But Moses could have got this book, as many people. I remember when I was in Sunday school, I just assumed this was true. Moses went up on the mountain, and God dictated five books to him. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. There's your five books. Now go on down the mountain. But when you get in and study it, it's like, that's not really the way it happened, nor does the Bible teach it that that's the way it happened. Moses did not get these books by direct revelation. Although there are clearly places in the first five books that God is dictating to Moses, telling him this is what you're supposed to do. The tabernacle account, God says, make it exactly the way I tell you to. Don't get creative, just like this. And he gives him word by word how to do it. So there is direct revelation. The other thing we've got in there is that there were oral stories, that these were stories handed down for years from the very beginning of time, stories that were handed down from person to person. And finally, Moses says, I ought to write this stuff down. And so Moses then took time and said, let me think. What did my mom and dad tell me at the bedtime story? Oh, yeah, they told me the story of Adam and Eve. And he began to write that. And that's probably got some truth to it also. I don't like that,
Because that leaves room for the liberal critics to come in and say, well, you know how stories go. They get bigger and grander every generation that tells them. Well, that just happens just between my high school career and telling my boys about my high school sports activities. They become grander and better. So you don't even need a generation, you just need a couple of years to improve the story. So that gets in the place for the oral tradition. I see some of the dads laughing right now because the sons know that's true. Well, when I was in high school, gosh, Dad, you must have been like all world, all state. Well, the coach didn't like me. Yeah. But anyway, but what I like, and again, you've got to be thinking here. I like the written documents that the, and we got to show you something, that these were written documents handed down. I mean, that, listen, I go back to this, that Adam could have wrote some things down. Man, I'm sorry, I've told you this before, but I'm going to review it again. And in the 1800s, late 1800s, the whole liberal critic movement, out here just real quickly, but the idea that Moses couldn't have written the first five books of the Bible because Moses couldn't write, because writing hadn't been developed by 1400 B.C. And that was that, listen, you may say, oh, I heard that too when I was in school. Well, you needed to get some new information. But that is what they used to teach, and everybody believed it. Since that time, they found out that writing goes way beyond before the time of that. Clearly, Moses, when Abraham left Ur of the Chaldeans, remember Genesis chapter 12, 2000 B.C.? They have found in Ur of the Chaldeans, over in Iraq, in that area there, in that city, that ancient, they have found an enormous ancient library of tablets written on that they had from in 2000 BC. They not only had writing, they had libraries. They were still going, hey, does this look like the letter A? They had already developed a library system in Abraham's day. And this keeps getting further and further back. They begin to realize that humans were smarter a lot earlier than we give them credit for. Because you think humanistic evolution, we think we're like on the pinnacle of intelligence. Because we've got computers and the gasoline engine, which by the way needs to be improved as quick as the computer is we think, well, everybody else was just, you know, Stone Age people and they couldn't even speak probably. They just grunted at each other. Had different sounds for what they wanted for breakfast or whatever. But these people were very intelligent, and I push that now, going way back to why, as a Christian, as someone who believes the Bible, why could not Adam have written? Now, if you're a secular humanist, Adam was a caveman. And clearly, he didn't even have fire. He was the first one to figure out between male and female. Look, that's a female. And that's your secular humanistic ideal of who Adam was. But the view of Adam is he was created from the hand of God. He was at the pinnacle of intelligence. And Adam not only named the animals, that's what it says, he classified the animals. He looked at his world and began to classify things, scientifically break things down. Adam was probably, according to the Christian ideal of thinking, was the most intelligent human being. He came directly from the hand of God in the form of perfection before sin entered the human race. Yeah, but he couldn't write, I bet. I bet you if he didn't write, it's because he didn't have to. He just remembered everything. But I'm telling you that I believe writing developed very early. Potentially, I can't make it a doctrine, but potentially at the time of Adam, that Adam could record things in written form. And so what we have through this, I'm going to show you here in just a moment, we have this book, in fact, I'll show you right now, apparently written documents. In fact, the word toledot, T-O-L-E-D-O-T, it means, it's a Hebrew word, it means, it's from the root, YLD, and it means to bear. It is translated by these words in the English Bible: genealogy, generations, account, family history, and ancestral narrative are different ways of translating the word teledot. Now, if you look, please, with me, go to Genesis, stay with me, Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. If you don't find this interesting, I'm trying to make it so it's interesting, because this is huge. For me, it's huge. Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. And you see this teledot formula, the teledot formula throughout the book of Genesis. It just keeps coming up. It just keeps popping in. Every time you switch a story, the teledot formula pops in, which gives credence or leaves way that these are written documents from the days of the people that lived these stories. And that Moses didn't just sit down on a mountain and receive divine revelation and write down stuff as God told him, although he did do that different times. Or Moses just didn't write down all of his bedtime stories that Amram and Jochebed, his parents, told him. Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. After finishing the seventh day of creation, the verse 4 says, this is the account, teledot, of the heavens and the earth when they were created. This is the account, or this is the written document of the heavens and the earth when they were created. Okay, that could have been written by Adam. Could have been written by Moses. It could have been written by anybody, but it appears to be a document separate. Go on, chapter 6, verse 9. Now, this is where it gets real convincing for me. Chapter 6, verse 9. We're now in the times of Noah. And notice how chapter 6, verse 9 begins. After giving us a little introduction about the times of Noah and how evil it was and what God was going to do, it says in verse 9, now, or this is the account, teledot, this is the account of Noah. This is the written document of Noah. Now, as you read through this, it tells you different things right here, but the thing that's impressive, it tells you like in verse 15, this is how you are to build it. The ark is to be 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. In other words, those are the measurements of the ark. When you look at those measurements, they're exactly the correct size or proportion of a naval vessel. They're not just some kid would make in the backyard and call it a boat. This is the same proportions that you use today in designing boats. I don't know anything about boats, so let's go on. Let's go on to another place. Look in verse, for example, there's several. Look in verse 11 of chapter 7, continuing in this account or the teledot of Noah. Look at this. Does this sound like a legend? Does this sound like a bedtime story? Now, I'll preach sermons like this, but I don't tell bedtime stories like this. Verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day all the springs of the great deep burst forth. You know what that sounds like? That sounds like a journal entry into a written document. It was on the 600th year, the 17th day of the second month date. This is what happened. How'd Captain Kirk say that on the TV show? Star date, yeah. It sounds just like that. And enters the document. And so we continue with information about Noah and the ark, which sounds like a first-hand eyewitness of someone who rode the storm out. Well, I don't know if I can believe that. Why can't you believe that? Well, I don't think Noah could write. But he could build this boat. I mean, he could build this by hand, a craft that would endure a flood and preserve all the animals. Let's go on. Chapter 10, verse 1. We'll move quickly now. After we finish the account of Noah, guess what? Chapter 10 begins and begins with this. This is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. This is the teledot of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons. And now begins to tell the story of what took place there. Then you get over to chapter 11, verse 10. This is the account, this is the teledot of Shem, and comes all the way up to the days of Terah. Now, who would have written this? Maybe Abraham, maybe Terah himself, because it always ends. But maybe the person that last one in the genealogy is mentioned is the one who wrote these things down. Then we get into chapter 11, verse 27. This is the account of Terah. And so now we got Abraham's story between chapter 11, verse 27. Abraham's story, all the details. And I think Abraham could have wrote these things down, or parts of them. Isaac might have wrote them down. But what I'm telling you is that when Moses came out of the land of Egypt with the slaves, they brought with them potentially documents that had been handed down that Abraham had inherited, gave them to Isaac, gave them to Jacob, gave them to the 12 sons. They have them in Egypt. They come out of Egypt with these written documents, and there goes Moses. He takes the written and puts them together in the Jewish history. He doesn't make it up. He doesn't tell a bunch of stories. He just lines up the doctrine or the documents and puts them in order form. And it continues. You've got the account of Abraham and Isaac. You've got the account of Isaac and Jacob, and all the way through. But if you look on their notes on page 1, the biblical scholars, the liberal scholars of the 1800s developed this and promoted this. It still is in churches today, some mainline churches today still believe this. And this is trash. This is garbage. This doesn't even hold water in common sense thinking. But it is enough to destroy the authenticity of Scripture and nullify any kind of authority it's got in our lives. It's called the JEDP theory. And this is, they look in there and they begin to see different writings in the book of Genesis. And they see, for example, someone who used the name Jehovah consistently in their writings. And so they pull that out and say, someone wrote this. And they say that came from around 850 B.C. Now, do you understand 850 B.C., you've got King David has come and gone. You've already gone through Ahab. Elijah's come and gone, or during that time period. So you are well through the Old Testament. And someone begins to write down some things. Actually, what they mean is make up some things about the history of the Jews. They use the name Jehovah in their writings. Then there is the one who uses the word Elohim. And they say that came around about 100 years later. That came around 750 BC. They began to add some more writings to this document that began in 850. And then you got the Deuteronomist, who began writing around 620, the times of Josiah's reform. When they found the scroll, according to the Bible, they found the scroll in the temple. Said, hey, we better start following the law of the Deuteronomy. And that's where a guy named the Deuteronomist began to add stuff to this. And then it comes after they come back after the Babylonian captivity, Ezekiel and Ezra, and during that time period, they added some more, and they added the priestly line. Now, what this is saying is that the law of Moses wasn't developed until around 620. And they just put it in this writing and told everybody, hey, you better follow the law of Moses. And more importantly, around after the Babylonian captivity, they developed the priesthood. They developed the temple. The temple never existed. Anything written about Solomon's temple and the tabernacle of Moses was added to these documents after the Babylonian captivity, just to help the people organize and get some continuity in their faith and their belief. That means that these people come back from Babylonian captivity, and this group of leaders get together and they make up a document. They make up a writing that says things like, "We are the priesthood, and you're not. We are the priesthood, and so." Well, as the priesthood, you need to bring us a tenth and even more, different tithes that they had, of all of your offerings and give them to us. The Bible says so. We just found this document. You add into that all the power, all the things they had of that. Then you throw into their circumcision. Say, hey, we got a great idea. All the men need to be circumcised. Why? Because we just found this document. And meanwhile, this whole time, the priests are saying, we just found this document that they just created. The whole people buy into it. The question would be, why should we trust you with this document if you've lost it for the last 2,000 years? Not only where did it come from. In other words, they sell this entire generation, this entire history of the book of Genesis. And that is the theory of the JEDP. And it waters the whole thing. It's all creation, man. So just forget it. It's all a legend. In fact, it's not even a legend. It's a political lie. It's a political spin to try and manipulate the people in later years. That is liberal scholarship right there. Okay, that's enough of that, please. We go back, please, to Genesis 1:1. And on page 2 of the notes, just real quickly, the two themes that we have in this beginning right here is the preparation of the land and the blessing of creation. Throughout this first chapter, it's going to be the preparing of the heiress, or the earth, or the land, and then the blessing that goes with it. The next thing we've got is the creators mentioned Elohim. We've talked about that. We've got some verses written down there, Jeremiah 10:11. These gods who did not make the heaven and earth will perish from the earth and from under the heavens. Psalm 96:5, for all the gods of the nations are idols, but the Lord, or Yahweh, made the heavens. Isaiah 46:9, I am God declaring the end from the beginning. The origin. Everything comes from, we already mentioned this, but I want to read these verses. I'm backtracking. This is what's wrong with having notes and not following them. Is everything is coming from this eternal God. We've got these verses. I want to look at these verses. Psalm 33, verse 6. I'd like to have you go there, please. I don't hear any pages turning. Wake up and turn. Give you something to do. The eternal God who created this is not just found in Genesis 1:1. The eternal God and Him being outside of creation, creating the universe, is found in these different verses. Psalm 33, verse 6. Psalm 33, 6. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, their starry host by the breath of His mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea into jars, and He puts the deep into storehouses. That's how he's eventually going to form the water. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the people of the world revere Him. For He spoke, and it came to be. He commanded, and it stood firm. So we see in the beginning God created. It involves His word where He created, and it came to be. He spoke, and it stood, or He commanded, and it stood firm. Let's go from Psalm 33. Let's go to John 1:3. You know this verse, John 1:3. This verse right here is
probably the written account of the oldest time period in history. John 1:1, we'll read 1 through 3. Not only does it say in Genesis 1:1, we have the beginning of creation. In the beginning, God, who existed previously, created the heavens and the earth. But in John 1:1, we go way past that. We go back, it says, in the beginning was the Word. So this is not saying in the beginning was the Word created. We're saying in the beginning, the Word's already there. In the beginning, the existence of the Word is already there, already present. And the Word was with God. Now we're getting into, if you want to start messing with the Trinity, now we're dealing with this right here, because we've got this identity called the Word, but we've got the Word that's separate from God because the Word was with God. And the Word, wait a minute, was God. So now you've got the Word and you've got God and the Word is with God, but at the same time, the Word is God. But the way it's written there, it doesn't mean that it is the God. It is, in a sense, it has got the character traits of God. So they're both eternal. The Word was in the position of God, as was the one called God in the position of God. He was with God in the beginning. Now, through Him, all things were made. Without Him, nothing was made that has been made. In Him was life, and that light was the light of life was the light of men. The light shines in darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. So in other words, that very creative force, that very creative presence, the Word, which we know as Jesus Christ, or the Son of God, the second member of the Trinity, was there with God, the eternal Father, the two of them, and He created. But it goes on and says that that Word is the light of the world. So this God, power, force, not only is the force of truth that is the good news, is Genesis 1:1 in the sense isn't over. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and there it is. This verse says, yes, He created everything. Nothing existed without Him having been made. But also, He, His presence, is the very light, the guidance, the truth that leads and guides us in this world. So the Creator is more than just a creative force. He is now the truth. He's the way. He's the light. He's our hope in creation. So not only is He the Creator, He is the hope within creation. And of course, we've got to go now to Hebrews chapter 11, please. Hebrews 11, verse 3. We'll begin in verse 1 of Hebrews. Just read into this. Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. This is what the elders in the previous dispensation were recognized for, that they could see beyond the natural world. This is a great verse. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Again, the certainty. We know a truth from the light that shines into our lives, from the Word of God that radiates in our hearts. We know the truth. And we know it without a shadow. We have a hope, and even though we don't see it, we know it. And then it's what are we supposed to do with that? Well, that is what in chapter 11, it lists all the people of the Old, or not all, but a list of heroes of the Old Testament who lived by faith, who had the Word in their heart and lived it out without seeing necessarily the results of that Word in their life, but they saw the hope of where it was going. This is what the ancients were commended for. They had faith in the light or the hope they had. Verse 3, by faith we understand, or we come to realize, we come to grips with the fact that the universe was formed at God's command. So that God, at His command, at His word, created all of this. Now, interestingly, right there, the word the word universe is the word aeone, which means the ages. So, on this, because this goes back to Genesis 1:1. We're thinking in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And material. First, universe is the word aeon, which means more than just mass of stuff, you know, the planets, the stars, the water. It means the air. That at His command,
He created time periods. And we're going to go right back to the book of Genesis, because when we go back to the beginning there, the word that first word, Bereshith. In fact, that's the next thing on your notes right there, if you don't mind. It means more than beginning. It means also a beginning of a time period with an end. You can't have a beginning without an end. So within this word, in the beginning, God created, the very first word in the Bible that the book is named after, beginning, is not just in a beginning that has no end or just at the point of creation. It refers to an entire process. Look at what I got written down here. Throughout the Bible, the word resit, R-E-S-I-T, which is in Bereshith, is used to mark a starting point of a specific duration. So within that word, in the Hebrew word, we capture what is being said here in Hebrews 11:3, that in the beginning means at the start of a process that is going to go for a period of time or a duration and have an end, God created the heavens and the earth. So within the word beginning, in Genesis 1:1, guess what? The last days, or eschatology, is within that word. In the beginning of a period of time that has an end, God created the heavens and the earth, which puts us right back in the position that we are here for a time. We're here for a purpose, that when this purpose is served, God is going to return, or things are going to change. This is not an eternal state. See, a lot of times, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and now here we are. We just go on forever and ever, and this is life. We just enjoy it. It's like, no, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth for a time period, for a purpose of which you've entered into and have joined into this process. You should pay attention and figure out what's going on. What is the purpose of this time period? Well, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's the pagan view. We are here following the philosophy and the purpose of our Creator. Hebrews 11:3 once again says, by faith, we understand that the universe could refer to the created matter, but aeonai, the Greek word, refers again to the time periods were formed at God's command, which leads us back to Genesis 1:1, please. And if page 3 of your notes, there are two verses that we're going to look at in just a minute, but again in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And again, that Bereshith right there is a word that has within it the ending. Let's go to, I should have had you go there instead. Go to Isaiah 65, please. Isaiah 65. Look at two verses here dealing with this thought. That as surely as God began creation, there is a time for it to be used, a time for its period, the duration, and at the end, there's going to be some ending to creation. And this isn't a secondary thought. In Isaiah, for example, Isaiah 65, verse 17. God says in Isaiah 65, verse 17, behold, I will create new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind. Now, when he says new heavens and new earth, that lines up exactly with what we talk about in Genesis 1:1. When we say the Hebrew word, I read this in a book, the Hebrew word, our English word universe, there's no Hebrew word for that. They can't say universe as the whole system. They've got a word for earth, and they've got a word for the stars and the planets, the atmosphere. And so to say universe, they can't say universe because there's no word for universe. They've got to say heavens and earth, or heavens and earth. And when they say heavens, they're not talking about, and probably now in our English understanding, they're not talking about the throne room of God. They're not talking about God's abode we call heaven. That's a whole other concept. Heavens, in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens, the solar system, and the earth. And so now when Isaiah 65 says, behold, I will create new heavens and a new earth, what do you think he's talking about? God's not talking about burning up his throne room and creating it again. That's perfect. That doesn't need to be redone. He's talking about the universe, the solar system, and the new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind. So just as in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, a time period, that is going to end. We see the same thing, if you don't mind, in Revelation 21. In Isaiah, go to Revelation 21. In Isaiah 65, the prophet mentions it. But in Revelation 21, John actually now sees this. And then when we go through eschatology, it all plays out in perfect order. We've gone through in chapter 20, verses 1 through 7. We go through the tribulation, or excuse me, the thousand-year reign of Christ. Chapter 20, verses 7 through, say 15 there, you've got the judgment of Satan on the last days on the earth, and then, of course, the great white throne judgment. But it even says in chapter 20, look in chapter 20, verse 11, please. Chapter 20, verse 11. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. That's the final judgment of all believers, of all unbelievers. Then it says, earth and sky fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. So the earth and sky, or if you want to say it, the earth and the heavens fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. Meaning this heaven and earth are gone. Peter talks about it being burned up. And Revelation 21, verse 1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth, according to Genesis 1, one word, Beresheth, had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. Gone. It's vanished. It's no longer here. So this is the where we end, going on into the new heaven and new earth. That is exactly where the word begins there in Genesis 1, 1, Beresheth, the idea of in a beginning of a duration of time. What else we got here on these notes? Oh, okay, here we go. The last and final portion. We mentioned the word at the very end there. I do have the word bara mentioned, created out of nothing. And the word asa, keep that in mind because you're going to see the word asa. Many times the word comes up of being created out of something that already exists. We're going to see that throughout the Genesis chapter 1. When it goes through the 7 days of creation there. Those are all making stuff out of things that already existed, which leads us to the last and maybe most complicated point. Okay, so if you're dozing off, just cash it in and just, you know, get something, a bulletin or something to look at here. But let's try this last little bit because this is important. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There is no article in the Hebrew. The word the is not there. So, for example, in the beginning, it is the phrase, in beginning, God created. Which leads us to some interpretation. What do we do with that? We put the word the in there to make sense. But when you get into exegetical work, what does it mean, beginning? And I've got four things written down there, four options on what has taken place right here. Is some people take this and they make it the first verse is a temporal clause. Now, here you go again. You've got a shop teacher dealing with English. So, you know, most of you are way beyond me on this. But the temporal clause means it's a statement that is hanging there waiting to be completed. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and we're waiting for something to explain what that means. You can also read that as an independent statement. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, in the English Bible, with the word the in there, now stay with me, it leans towards that independent side. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that's why I can preach a whole sermon on that verse, because that's what he did. Well, what about how he did it? It's like that's a whole separate issue. That's a whole another set of verses. We've just established the fact that God has created the heavens and the earth. Now, that is what the English Bible says right here when you ever put that word the in there. Meaning it's an independent statement. It stands alone. Some scholars, especially in the 1900s, the good conservative scholars, didn't like that because it gives the idea that in the beginning, that before the creation account of the 7 days, the earth and all the matter was already there, giving the impression that matter was in existence before God began to create, which gives credence to theistic evolution, or if you want to throw the whole thing away, evolution. Because there's matter in existence before God got there, the way it stands as an independent statement. And so throughout the 1900s, the conservative scholars have been trying to defeat that and point that out, that there is no article in the beginning, and it's an independent clause, or it's a temporal clause dependent on something else to explain it. The problem with that, do you understand what I'm saying? If not, get the CD. If you didn't like it the first time, you're not going to get the CD, and then listen to it again. The problem with that is the phrase beginning, like in Isaiah 46:10, it can stand alone, meaning it can talk about that time. It doesn't have to be a temporal statement dependent on something else, which means, even as it's written in the Hebrew, it can stand alone, as in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. End sermon. We'll be back next week to tell you what happens next. There are those who say you can't stop there. You've got to read it all together, chapter 1, verse 2, chapter 1, verse 3. Put it all together. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. You've got matter standing there, the creation standing there alone with God in eternity, and then you have the creation. I believe, because of the way it is in the other place in the Old Testament, I believe in the way it lines up here, that word, I go with numbers, see those options, four options, 1, 2, 3, and 4. I go with option 3. It is an independent sentence. Verse 1 is an independent sentence making 1-1 the act of creation, and 1-3 begins to reveal further phases of God's work after the creation of 1-1. Now, many scholars, I've got to tell you this up front, many scholars, good conservative scholars, will not like that because it separates the two. It gives you what they call the gap. The idea that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, there we go, we're happily ever after, here's the creation. And then at some point in time, verse 2 takes place. Oh, look, it's a mess. And then God looks into chapter 1, verse 3, looks at the mess and says, you know, we got to fix this up. And we've got a whole nother account. So 1-1 creation, 1-2 is the account of how it all got messed up, or that it did. And then chapter 1, verse 3 begins to create what we would say, or excuse me, I don't want to put you in this category yet, what I would say leads us to the recreation, the reforming of what took place in 1-2 that destroyed 1-1. And throughout the 1900s, people have come against that because they think you're giving credence to evolution, where you're not. It's just the way it's written. In the beginning, God created this thing. I'm just telling you what I think. You're going to have to make a decision. Please don't leave the church because you disagree. Leave the church because of I'm mean on the webpage or something. But don't leave because of that. Just keep listening. 1-1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and there it stands. Then as an independent clause, it leaves it there, and in chapter 1, verse 2, something happens. And you don't need evolution. That's what took place. And that is a way we're going to approach it and look at it. And I want you to go now, we're going to close, I think, with this, Psalm 74, because many times throughout the creation stories in the Scriptures, when they refer to it in Psalms, or the prophets, you have something here taking place. And I addressed this 2 or 3 weeks ago. No. A month and a half ago. That there is something else taking place in this whole thing. There is the rebellion of Satan. There is the rebellion of Lucifer. Somehow this gets, it's infected the world. It's something within us. This is not something that everybody agrees. Everybody agrees that Satan's a problem. Everybody agrees that Satan fell, got cast out of heaven. But when, how, and where it happened is open to debate. Some people don't think it's open to debate. Look at this. Look at this creation account. Do you notice anything in this? This is for you to think now. Psalm 74, beginning in verse 12. You ready? Now, well, I'm just going to read it to you. I want to preface this, but let's just see if you can catch something in here. If not, if you just hear it's like, I don't know what he's talking about. I'm sorry. Chapter 74 of Psalms, verse 12. But you, O God, are my King from of old, ancient days. You bring salvation upon the earth. Now don't think Jesus Christ on the cross. Although that is salvation upon the earth. Jesus is the source of salvation. But this salvation is way before the cross. It says in ancient days, salvation, deliverance came to the earth. It was you who split open the sea by your power. Oh, it must be the Red Sea. It could be the Red Sea, except we're talking about ancient days. It could be the Red Sea. It was you who split open the sea by your power. You broke the heads of the monster in the waters. It was you who crushed the heads of Leviathan. Leviathan is a word for the word twisted. And gave him as food to the creatures of the desert. It was you who opened up springs and streams. You dried up the ever-flowing rivers. The day is yours, and yours also the night. You established the sun and the moon. Now clearly we're into creation. We're not into the deliverance from Egypt. It was you who set the boundaries of the earth. All these things are to take place yet, my friends, in the Genesis 1 verses 3 through the rest of that chapter. What we would consider, I consider, the recreation, the reforming of the earth. So what we have here, when he goes back to the ancient days, you remember, we're going to see in chapter 1, verse 2, the chaos. The waters are going to cover the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Meanwhile, now, the earth is covered with water. And it's like, there's no light. It's chaos. It's empty. And now what we're talking about here, you see right in here in this creation account, notice what's taking place in the creation account here. What I want to point out, there is a struggle. There is a battle. There is the twisted one whose heads, plural, is crushed. And if you want to follow that heads throughout Scripture, those heads resurface in Revelation when Satan begins to manifest himself as the Antichrist. Those heads are popping up. These heads are always associated with the powers of Satan on the earth. And here they're crushed, and the earth, what happens after he crushes the heads of the twisted one? It says, he opened up the springs and streams. He dried up the ever-flowing river. That would be the chaotic waters. The day is yours, and the night. That's chapter 1, verse 3, right there. It's later on. It's the fourth day of creation. Establish the sun and moon. In other words, we've got a battle that's about to take place. What I think what we have here, and you've got to think, you've got to decide, and I'm not always right, but I'm always teaching. Chapter 1, verse 1 is the creation, an independent clause. God created the heavens and the earth. There they are. There's a time period for them. There's a duration. It's included in the word, Beresheth. It's a time period, and it's going to come to an end. What we get to next week now is there was a struggle that had to be resolved. The earth all of a sudden is chaotic. There's a chaos that needs to be resolved, and it begins to be resolved when the Spirit of God begins to hover and we head on to those other days of creation. Let me say this as I close. The other way of viewing that, which would be acceptable, is that, remember teledote? The word, this is the written account. This is the written account of Shem. This is the written account of Terah. This is the written account of Jacob. And then they tell the story. Genesis 1:1 could be a teledote. This is the account of creation, how it took place. The problem with it, the word teledote is not there. It doesn't say teledote. It doesn't say this is the written account. It just says an independent statement, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. But some would say, but it's a teledote also. This is the account of how the heavens and earth came to be. But the problem with that is you begin with a watery, chaotic mess. And it goes from there. So I don't think it's a teledote. Some people say it's a teledote, it's account, and it's dependent upon the rest of the story to explain to you what is taking place in that verse 1:1. I think 1:1 stands by itself, as we see in Psalms, we see in 1 John, John 1, we see it in Hebrews. God spoke and it came into existence. There it is. Now, we do have a problem. We do have the twisted one who's in rebellion towards God, and God's going to now begin to resolve that and put man on the earth. But we'll continue. Please think about, hey, if you got any opinions about that, I've got a great place for you to go and type all your thoughts and share them with each other. But remember, I do have a delete button. All right, Father, we do thank you for your word. We do ask that you may lead us and guide us, and we take the truth and apply it to our lives. We do ask that we would find application for these things in our daily thinking, our daily living. And again, we thank you so much for who you are and what you've done in our lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.